Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, immaculate.
Now listen to this.
I'll tell you about this. Another dilapidated and somewhat distorted version of Zuma Time, the Mind Body Magic Hour, second edition. It's Wednesday, so boy is my hump day tired. I had so many hills and valleys in this. I'm not even sure I could describe it if I had to see it in a Rorschach test from the side. How you doing out there in Blog Talk Radio land? The number to call to get a hold of me is 646-478-4847. Lots on the docket tonight. Oh, my God. I can't even describe how many directions this show can go. Coming up soon, we got Mr. Trendsetter, Mr. Trend Hunter, Mr. Fancy, Mr. Exploiting Chaos, Jeremy Gutsky. I got to be able to pronounce his name. I'm going to fake it till he gets here. Coming up about 10 minutes, hopefully, as per his email, and everyone follows through on what they email me, right? No, I don't think so there, Wilbur. Let me water down. So, I can't even tell you. Where do we start? We start with Sammy Sosa's skin? Where do we start? I think we start with a little swine flu. There's some news out there. Let me see where my swine flu little thing. Here it is. Right?
Son of a bitch, gun. You thought I was
going to
say son of a bitch, didn't you?
Yeah, well, as we have documented on this program for many months now, there has been just a plethora of fear-monging behavior from the alopecia that has come through, and now it has affected the cats. We've talked about NBA players, NFL players that have been tested positive for H1N1. But now, my patron state of confusion, Iowa, has checked in. And a 13-year-old indoor cat has been tested positive for the swine flu. Unbelievable. Two or three members of the family that owned the pet had suffered from influenza-like illness before the cat became ill. It's not completely unexpected. The cat got the flu. That's unbelievable. And ferrets have now gotten the flu. But they're still out there sticking shots in people. We've all been exposed. The entire southern hemisphere is done with it. And it's running through us like I don't know, poop through a goose. And yet they still think they can prevent some type of epidemic. The cats are getting it. Unbelievable. This is how, like I said, when you deal with bugs, a smart bug goes from host to host and host and doesn't kill many of them unless they happen to be already pretty much condemned buildings, then, you know, that brings down the house. But most people just get it, go through it, crap it out, and they're done. Why do they need to stick us with this, you know, highball of ingredients that they will not reveal, by the way, and get people more sick? It's amazing. If the cats are getting it, how strong is this thing? But they're scaring people with this news. Oh, the cats are getting it. And the ferrets. Maybe the little birds flying over your head have it, too. Iowa cat. I can't stand it. This is absolutely hilarious. So that came across the wire. I just had to get that out before we got any deeper into the program. Because it was one of those things where I just said, how far and wide will the media go to scare people to getting their shots? How far and wide? There you go. Cats. We're at that point. I almost had that song, the Calico Cats, up here. It just couldn't be any time. But I don't even know what to do anymore with this. So where are we going? Where are we going with this program? I have no idea. I have no idea anymore because I get on here every week, and what I'm trying to really do in the hour or so we spend together here, or I spend talking to myself mostly, is to get you to understand ideas catch your attention. What ideas catch your attention? Why does that grab you? Where does that come from? We get a guest on here. I want to know when he was sitting there, you know, on the kitchen table hatching that idea, what came to mind? And then how did he get other people to adopt it? Because that's all that happens. Ideas spread from brain to brain and life to life through receptivity. And when I talk to some addicts, and if you haven't visited somaspace.org, that's my site. That's my site. And it's going to be revamping as I take a swig. The next week or two, as I've been tinkering and tonkering with what to do. And I'm going to put it to you guys because been doing this show 2.5 years now for about maybe 9-10 months all by myself. Professor Val is fast asleep right now because she has this condition.
I got a bad liver and a broken heart.
Anyway, so she's moved on to doing her rant show. You can catch that. Professor Val, if you want to search for it or get a hold of me at nakedsoma@gmail.com, I'll happily pass along that information. And, everyone's doing what they should be doing. So I'm up here, Yapster, and I got basically two ways I can go with this. We could talk about you and all your pain and suffering and limitations and all your aberrant behaviors. Your loco patterns, low coherence patterns, that cause you to fall prey to the swine fear, for example. Or we can talk about us, and we can get into the four domains and how our behavior is guided by them and what influences them and how can we get in rhythm with them, how can we become more aware of these signatures of our nature. I kind of want to go that direction, but, you know, I don't know. I've been going back and forth and back and forth like some kind of, you know, nearsighted cyclops that just, you know, because I'm trying to get a message out that's consistent. Yet I'm here on the ground in Larchmont, and now I'm here in the sky with you guys. So I'm going to, you know, be making some changes to the way we do things to get a clearer, consistent message out every week. Now, that said, what happened to Sammy Sosa? What the frig happened to Sammy? Anyone see this? Just a little item. One of those things that kind of scrolls by. Sammy Sosa, if you know, remember, baseball player, all that stuff. They're calling him the new Michael Jackson. Okay, that's you know, and Sammy's career was sort of shrouded in controversy with the whole steroids thing. And if you've seen pictures of him lately, I mean, basically it's night and day. And he's claiming it's from this cosmetic cream. It's a bleaching cream he applies to whiten his skin. Now, it's a cream he has. He softens his skin. He bleached him some. He's not a racist. He lives his life happily. It's very strange. You got that news on one end, and then you got what happened to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar on the other end with the leukemia thing. Both of these sort of little cultural tidbits are part of a trend that we're going to get into with our guest in a minute that I'm going to touch upon here. See if you guys can get into it. Hopefully he calls in. It's almost at the time, so we see what happens. I don't know. He's a busy man. He's a busy man. So let's see if Elvis is around. Give us the rules.
There's two things you need to know. Uh-huh. I'm the king. And number two is look out, man.
There you go. All right. Wow. So that was the second item of forbids because I wanted to see, you know, if you're layering these things, and then a lot of people do, you know, when they get news that's kind of frivolous like that, and then they get news like the swine flu that's not so frivolous, it usually comes back to back and the belly to belly. So here we are, a week removed from the Yankees winning the World Series, where the Giants lost a tough game on Sunday. I'm still feeling the effects of it. These are things I do. This is my dopey life, right? I'm into the sports. And our guest last week chastised me about that, but that's neither here nor there. So again, what we're really looking for tonight is to take all the flux that's out there. There's so much of it. The economy and the war and of course, the flu and all these different things that are really kind of impairing our ability to function, I think, as a collective culture, and put them into a context that we can actually leverage them and get out of the soup and get to the other side of the rainbow, right? How do we get there? Well, you have to have somewhat of a template, right? You have to have a way to say to yourself, I'm able to overcome these obstacles because I have a vision that doesn't include the obstacles. Like, the obstacles are there, but there's a course. There's a way through. And then, oh, right on time. Here's our guest. He will then... Alright, joining us from an undisclosed location. I guess you're out west, 416. I don't even know where that is.
Who wouldn't love that kind of intro?
Well, I don't know. We'll find out. Arthur Jeremy. And how do you pronounce your last name? I'm gonna fake
Gucci.
It. Gucci. Ooh, Gucci kind of rhymes with a lot of things. From Trend Hunter Magazine and the author of Exploiting Chaos. Now, I'm a lover of chaos from the scientific side of it, of course, and maybe some of the cultural side. But your place, if anyone's been to that site and still has eyeballs, I want to meet them because it is candy every direction you go. And you seem to have taken some of the elements of the old Nerve magazine. Remember that one?
Yeah.
The edgy Nerve. It's not edgy anymore, but it's gotten kind of like, you know, neutered a little bit. And a little bit of the TMZ, edgy, kind of like gossipy stuff, and made it into sort of this living picture of the culture that sort of kind of comes at people, you know, almost three-dimensionally, because there's so much going on. I just ran the gamut from Sammy Sosa changing his skin color to cats catching swine flu, you know, and these things are what are in people's heads as they're walking around during a day, and then, you know, Kareem's got leukemia. How do people deal with the volume of news that doesn't affect them personally but keeps collectively hitting us over the head from all these different angles? And how do they put this into context when it's happening all at once?
At TrendHunter.com, what we're really interested in is what are all these things that are going viral, creating buzz, and becoming interesting to people. So the way we kind of look at our site in some ways is that from our perspective, it's a bit of an experiment. So we've got a crowdsourced model where anybody could add content, and that means any given day we add 100 to 200 different articles. And we're always looking for things that are kind of on the edge, new ideas. But then what we do is we're able to look at the sort of viewer patterns and see what's really taking off. And then on our research side, you know, we can kind of find the groups of things that are meaningful, which then, you know, could be interesting to companies that are kind of looking for the next big thing.
Okay.
So the idea then is, if you've got all of this noise, what can you learn by just looking at the patterns of the things that are really grabbing people's attention, and then, you know, really try and filter down into opportunity.
So let's just take an example, okay? What happened with Twitter back a couple months ago in Iran when the elections were going on and everybody was going crazy on Twitter. Twitter has become, you know, and a year ago it was still around, but it hadn't crested. Is how do you separate a technological fad from a technological trend?
Well, I think what's interesting, if we look at something like Twitter, and not necessarily think of it in itself as the fad or trend, but more suddenly we've got a new medium that people are using to communicate. And the cool thing about it is that because it's, you know, electronic, we can actually use it to study what people are talking about, how quickly are different items of news traveling. And you're still seeing it in its infancy. I mean, there's a lot of different apps that try and make it a bit more useful, but it's still kind of rough. But as it keeps on evolving, you'll really start to get you know, a lot of neat analytical tools that pop out of it as people find out how to, like, unearth what's actually driving the buzz out there, and, you know, how is information spreading.
Now, define something that, like, I'll take another example, this movie Paranormal Activity, that was basically another one of these low-budget, you know, sort of guy borrowed his last dime to film it kind of thing. He actually got Spielberg involved in the end of it for some reason. And they made the movie basically on demand to spread it through from the art theaters they had it out west to all these major theaters. And it was the number one movie in the country for a while. How did things like that pattern, the indie movies and all the things, these things become movements. These things become sort of cultures in and of themselves. How do these things gain traction? So there's so many things
sure.
that fail, and things get through.
In the Exploiting Chaos in the book, I kind of break that framework down, and this is something we study a lot of at Trend Hunter, so we're really trying to look for what goes viral, because obviously we're trying to tap it and understand it. So we like to see there's basically three ways. You can have a viral creation, which is the sort of product or service itself. You can have a viral medium, which is the delivery itself, like how you found out about it or how this movie is being screened or disseminated itself is what's so interesting and viral, which, you know, even explains Twitter. Or you can have a really well-packaged story where everything is so unique and interesting that it just grabs your attention. So if we talk about the product or idea itself, basically things that are unique and sort of edgy, that are shocking or surprising are the types of things that pass the I have to tell someone test. And as soon as you can pass the I have to tell someone, something's that interesting, then you're going to have all the properties that could make something viral. And now that people are so much more connected, either in the blogosphere or Twitter or YouTube, if you have a product that's that interesting, that connects that well, your message today has the potential to travel faster than ever before. Mm-hmm. And if we take the other end of that spectrum where I was just taking well-packaged stories, it's interesting to see companies that really live their theme and kind of push things to the very limit to the point that you just have to talk about them. So have you ever heard of there's a place that has the biggest, ugliest-looking burger you ever did see, and it's in Phoenix, Arizona. And if we talk about them for a second, they call themselves the Heart Attack Grill. And at the Heart Attack Grill, the burger itself is called a quadruple bypass burger.
Mm-hmm.
And they serve it to you in a combo pack that includes 3 packs of cigarettes and 3 beer. And someone in a nurse's outfit will serve it to you. And if you finish it, they'll put you in a wheelchair and roll you back to your car. So
right.
if you look at that, that's an example of a story where when you see the whole thing, the theme is so unique and interesting that then once you hear about it, you're sort of inclined to tell someone else about it. And so it all gets back to that same sort of supercharged test of you know, do I have to tell someone?
So have these social medias, especially the ones that, you know, have spread to the iPhone, has that become the new digital water cooler? Like, see it, saw it, spread it, you know, it's like basically instantaneous where before it would take 6 months, 9 months, a year for these things to crest. Now they're cresting in you know, a month, a week.
Yeah, so I'd say the blogosphere, Twitter, YouTube in combination have created a new platform. I mean, if you look at the blogosphere, when you write an article that's really interesting, you might get 100 sites that are linking to you and then 1,000 sites link to them, and it continues on, fast forward a little bit, and you know, the next thing you know, this item's gone mainstream. And if it's really good, that'll carry on quicker. Twitter has made it sort of more democratically available so that everybody can spread that news. It used to be, if we rewind 2 years ago, that only the bloggers and especially the influential bloggers had the power to really spread a message. But because so many people are on Twitter and because you can send those at messages and just, you know, 140 characters of data, it really makes it so that you can you know, see things take off quickly.
And again, going back to your book that studies this, when we hit kind of the wall, you know, about a year ago, economically, everybody started to feel it. Everyone got short arms. We went through a really, you know, tight holiday season with merchants and things like that. What were the messages back then that you were tracking that had some positivity to it, that had some sort of way to kind of
sure.
burn through the fog that is still tracking now?
Yeah, so a Trend Hunter, again, it's like an experiment, and we look for a whole bunch of little examples, and then we group them up in our research. So around the time we started seeing a lot of interest in any time that someone would publish about, let's say, sneakers that you design yourself, that you draw the outside, T-shirts that you make yourself, handbags you make yourself, bringing back some sort of vintage clothing, making your own earrings. So we started seeing the pattern then of what we were calling credit crunch couture, which is just this idea that, you know, even designers were starting to come up with like Hermes came out with a do-it-yourself status bag where you actually would draw on the outside yourself, or Vivienne Westwood came out with an entire line of clothing made of scrap material, like tablecloth, curtains, and old clothing. But this idea then, if you sort of relate it to the credit crunch, is that suddenly not only were people looking for fashion that they could create themselves, but they were afraid of sort of wearing those overpriced labels out in the open and sort of being judged for showing off. And so suddenly you had interest in anything that looked like it was credit crunch couture, even if it was suddenly Hermes that was making it and it was still expensive but just had that look. So that would be an example of the types of things that you start to see when you look through the patterns and really try and look for multiple examples of something that seems like a meaningful group.
And again, one of the phrases that kind of came out of that last winter, especially here in the East Coast, is the concept of a staycation.
Right.
And the hotels and the restaurants, they all seized on this because people couldn't travel. They couldn't afford to go anywhere. And it became something that carried through all the way to the summer, actually. First time ever, you know, I've been practicing out here about 18, 19 years now. I had a lot of families that just basically didn't go away. The ones that stayed, some of them just left completely because they were working on the tip of Manhattan and they had to get out. But the ones that stuck around, it became much. They rediscovered their neighbors. They rediscovered a lot of things that they had blinders on for. So do you think the culture's changed forever as a result of that?
Well, there's an interesting piece of research we were working with. Did a pretty big study with Trend Hunter and American Express and Angus Reid up in Canada, but we did in a couple countries. And what we looked into is we found a new group that we're calling potentialists, which is this idea that, especially after the credit crunch, people are sort of rethinking their priorities in life, and a very significant portion of people are placing a higher emphasis on associating their personal fulfillment with, their life fulfillment with personal fulfillment, like hobbies, crafts, spending more time with family, getting more out of your vacation, then tying it just to their career, which is what they had been doing before. So I think your question there hits directly on that point, and you are seeing people sort of putting a bigger emphasis on that lifestyle part of their lives. And I think the neat thing about it is that the credit crunch has caused this meaningful shift, and there may be a couple reasons why you could see it to continue. So one would be you've got baby boomers who are growing closer to, you know, the last, let's say, decade of their working careers and sort of thinking about whether or not they've focused their life in the right place. So they're going to get the most of it in their final decade of work. And on the other side, you've got young urban professionals who grew up as a generation that always had a safety net, and so they were already more likely to be wanting to try and experiment with more things that are personally fulfilling, as opposed to generations before them, which had a pretty big mandate to have to go work, and all that wonderful thing, which leads you to a more routine, business-focused life.
And again, this is one of those things where on this side of the mirror, we're talking about the potentialist. A couple of years ago, It was still in the hippy-dippy-doo circles, like the Lojas group and people like that. They were talking about simplifying their lifestyles and yuppies that were discovering, you know, I want to live in the exurbs and I don't want to be in the corporate ladder anymore. But that was when we had an economy, you know. So they were looked at as being fringe, and now all of a sudden the bell curve moved over their heads and now they're leaders.
Sure.
So has that happened in other fields that basically on this side of the wave are now more in the middle of the bell curve, or before they were sort of out at the extremes?
Well, I think just to sort of relate this back, you always see pretty big changes like this whenever you go through a big chaotic shift. And in the book, I don't know if you got the first chapter there. It's available for free. If anyone goes to trendhunter.com, they can download it. But I have a list of companies that were founded during periods of economic recession. And the list is pretty impressive.
Looking at the old ads, you know, because it's the same tricks we're using now, only much more kind of like a film strip.
Right.
You know, the cigarettes and ads and things like that. It was great stuff. If you guys haven't checked it out, exploitingchaos.com, there's a free chapter link. Click on it. Is it a PDF they can download, or is it just stream?
They can get the first section as a free download.
Okay.
But what's interesting is, to get back to your questions, from Disney, CNN, MTV, Hyatt, Burger King, FedEx, Microsoft, Apple, those are just a few of the companies founded during periods of economic recession. And we tend to approach these times of chaos, and sort of at first people are shocked and a little bit worried about what they're doing, but people are still buying things. It's just that their priorities change. And so companies that are able to kind of identify what those new changes are able to reinvent. And so I guess that's the sort of positive message that comes out of all these things.
Yeah, and again, there's always seems to be, especially because people are intimately involved with it economically, of course, there always seems to be a certain percentage of companies that will emerge that didn't have any purpose to exist before when you get into one of these troughs, and then they become industry leaders going forward as the hill climbs. So what have you guys noticed since maybe a little bit of the economic recovery, you know, kind of started when the stimulus package came out, say back in the spring, that now that the leaves have fallen, are sort of now riding this crest, and what's fallen by the wayside?
Sure. Well, one of the neat areas is I mentioned before the idea that with you know, people sort of reprioritizing their life, they're putting an emphasis on hobbies and also I mentioned travel. In that travel category, something we've seen that's pretty neat is we're calling it supercharged tourism, but this idea that we're getting a lot of interest anytime we write about examples of vacationing that aren't just looking at the main sites. So whether or not it's getting a language course, a dancing lesson, a cooking course, or volunteering when you're on your vacation, the point is that now people are trying to get a lot more out of those experiences. So you're trying to really have an enriched vacation, but not just looking at those main sites. So, I mean, that would be one of the neatest examples. And there used to, if I rewind back a year or two ago, there used to be just a lot of traffic anytime we wrote about anything luxury. There was, you said, what's fallen on the wayside? Well, it used to be that blinged out anything was, you know, popping up everywhere. People had $150,000 gear shift knobs for their Bentleys and $2,000 coffee makers. And we actually started calling our collections of these articles, we put the titles Bling Bling Boring on them because there were so many companies that were getting, you know, international headlines for having the next $2,000 cocktail or whatever it might mean. And suddenly that's an example of something that's just sort of no longer interesting when it hits the media.
Now take a couple of industries that are always kind of omnipresent in the culture, music and movies. How have they adapted? Because out of all the industries out there, the content providers, the artists, have been basically a lot of they can't protect it. It's all been, you know, pirated out and stuff like that. And you talk about the bling bling. They've gone from, you know, if you could just look at maybe a window from 2006 or so to now, they've gone from an era where it was all about pointing at themselves and more chains around the neck and look at me, to being extremely savvy in being able to infiltrate themselves into things like, you know, like what JC did last week with the World Series, where he literally wrote the soundtrack for the entire Yankee World Series parade, everything, and that song became something that, you know, they were playing it at a Knicks game in Charlotte last week, and the Knicks were warming up in Charlotte, North Carolina. They're playing this song, so it. How do these guys, I mean, there's rare exceptions. I mean, individual artists are more savvy at it than others. How do they play the culture so well?
There's a couple things there. One of the first parts I was thinking about when you started asking your question about how the economy is impacting sort of media, movies, music, is that you do actually see in a recession, I think we saw it this year, there are quite a lot more comedies, let's say, than there have been in the past. And in fashion, we suddenly see a resurgence of bright colors or things that you know, jewelry that's brighter, exciting, things that kind of denote a more happier time. And you'll see that reflected kind of throughout pop culture. In terms of the artists doing new things like Jay-Z kind of making the anthem there, I think there's another part of that where the music model has changed. You can no longer simply be complacent with the CD sales that you're going to get. Now it's about concerts, but that model was already there. So you have artists that are really pushing to infiltrate new areas, whether it's product placement or, I mean, Jay-Z's got a multi-million person personal community of followers. People like Ashton Kutcher are really getting in Twitter. But the point is you're seeing celebrities that are realizing that in order to monetize their brands, they have to get them out there and sort of pursue completely new avenues. The music doesn't just cause money to flow in the door like it used to.
No, and they don't get the signing bonuses. Again, the industry, like in movies too, again, individual actors and mostly you see now a whole crop of directors that are becoming sort of forces of nature. And Michael Moore is a perfect example of someone who basically rewrote the perception of documentaries in the last 10 years and became a social commentator and a political, you know, influence about it. What have you seen? Like, I'm thinking of these old industries. Like what's happened to radio? Because here's an industry that's as old as time, pretty much, as far as communication goes. But it's been I don't want to say, you know, kind of mutated, but it's been so fragmented and so bastardized and so limited. Here we are on Blog Talk on internet radio. What do you see the next year and a half, 2 years going forward? What happens to terrestrial? What happens to satellite? What happens to internet radio?
So I think the interesting point about the trends that topple corporations and cause new business models is that you already know, you know, if we were to sit down and try and brainstorm through them, we could already come up with all the things that are changing the world. So you've got, you know, the blogosphere is challenging traditional media. Trend Hunter is an example. We get more traffic than most newspapers, but we're a very small staff. You've got viral videos challenging broadcast television, e-commerce, stores, social media is challenging, you know, even regular email, Wikipedia, public libraries. These are the things that are actually changing the world. But the reason why people don't take them serious is because you only notice shocking changes. It's kind of like the urban legend of boiling a frog. They say if you put a frog into a pot of boiling water, he'll pop out immediately and he'll be really pissed off at you. But instead, if you put the frog into lukewarm water and slowly dial up the heat, it'll be boiled alive. So like us, the frog is more sensitive to shocking change. And so people tend to think about this credit crunch as a big trend or something that happened, but really it's just a catalyst to everything else that was happening. So then if we look at different pieces of media, I think that, again, when you talk about TV, there's definitely a mode there where online, Apple TV, Hulu, viral videos, these kind of things start accelerating in time like now. But radio, your other point, is a little bit more interesting because at the end of the day, you listen to radio for a lot of people when they're in their car. And it's still a captivating form. You can't actually make radio you know, much better in a way because you're listening to a human voice, someone you're interested in that kind of captures you. So you could take away the commercials, there's a couple little areas, but it's in some ways as evolved as it gets. The only difference is that now the platform is a little different, which is that you have people kind of interested in XM radio, but perhaps the next step is that you start getting satellite radio in your car. I think the new sort of cell phones that are coming out, at least in Canada, are about five times faster than GSM, and this means in theory you could download internet radio, and instead of getting XM, you could just stream that right into your car, and these things happen. So if you're a podcaster or if you're someone with a radio station, I think you're actually in an interesting opportunity right now where the next stage isn't really defined yet, but it is something that could be a pretty nice opportunity. Take things to the next level.
Now, you guys have a phrase that I guess has become sort of mainstream, this whole the concept of jumping the shark. And it goes back to Fonzie, you know, if anyone that wants to Google it, there I am talking code again. But there seems to be almost like a nine lives to the jumping the shark thing for certain memes, certain ideas. What has jumped the shark in the last, say, year or so that didn't come back? Because it seems like whatever goes out of fashion or out of style, whatever, seems to find a sort of way to kind of backwash itself into the culture, whether it's reality TV or wherever these things are. What has literally jumped the shark and went splat and died that you could rest in peace?
Well, I mean, the first thing you had me thinking about was a line from 30 Rock where Liz Lemon's boyfriend says, "Come on, Liz, beepers are still going to be good. Technology is cyclical." So, and obviously, yeah, of course, it's not. So, I mean, I think that when you see technology, these are some of the areas where you'll see things leapfrog, but retro doesn't really come back other than this style. I think when it comes to fashion or the design of products, you know, characters, this is where retro's an interesting thing, and we see each decade come back. But
we have such a nostalgic culture, especially when it comes to cartoons and movies and things like that, that we seem to have this almost like, I don't know, like an undertow where we go forward three steps, where we drag two or three steps behind, and it's like things don't change in a very kind of digital way. Like one minute they're there, one minute they have this analog drag to them. So what do you see as like, I mean, it used to be everybody was concerned with security on the web and piracy on the web and things like that. And now, like, Facebook is merged with Google and, you know, everybody's glomming together again. Has all of that e-commerce stuff and all that kind of, you know, toe in the water gone away? Or is that jumped the shark? Is the fear gone? Or are we still living in an age where, like, you know, every once in a while they just hack into Twitter and crash it, and people just take it in stride, where before it was like every time there was any type of problem on the web, people started panicking, looking at their bank accounts, you know, and now I don't see that as much. It's more about identity theft, individuals.
Yeah, you know, it seems like we're a fear-driven culture, and so there's always something, and maybe it's identity theft, and then all of a sudden it's 9/11, and then it's terrorism, and then all of a sudden it's, you know, there's always something, I think, that gets everybody really excited, and half the time it's something that isn't even, you know, as worrisome. Other times maybe it is, but what are you going to do about it? So I'm sure we'll see a dozen more things, although it's tough to predict what's going to be the next pandemic scare.
Yeah.
What's the next H1N1 to give you the most current?
Yeah, exactly. Well, tackle that for me, because this is one of those things where I wanted to get into that divide line. Is it the content, the actual, like I say, the story, the meat of it, the nuts and bolts of it, that drives viral projections of information? Or is it the context that people meet it in, like a YouTube, like one of these newer social networks where it spreads all over the place, and you're getting your permission slip, so to speak, from people you know, rather than, you know, the major networks and things like that, and we've gone offline from that. So something like swine flu, that you have all these experts, I call the CDC the Center for Disease Cheerleading, because they're always, you know, promoting some disease down there, whether it's SARS or, you know, up here we had the Western Nile virus. So they always find some disease to go up and get the pom-poms out for. And then they have the WHO, you know, ratcheted up to a stage 6 pandemic. And then the evidence comes back, and it's like, well, it doesn't look like it was that bad. But they continue to pump because they got to get the vaccine out there, the second wave of it, because there's a cottage industry tagging along with that, a big farmer that rides underneath it. So is it context-dependent that flu season, they declare it flu season, like they declare the spring allergy season, and then all the allergy lobbyists go crazy? Or is
when we study viral, I mean, we really break it down to say you can have it's the viral products, viral mediums, or well-packaged stories. So if something's all within a theme, it works really well. But if I give you other examples of things that can go crazy that aren't even – yeah, you know, like I've had products that are just boring products. I remember one that was just a reverse shower or something like this. You put it on the ground, it looks like a sprinkler. It's a shower. But just to give you an idea of how the medium itself can make something travel, the person that wrote or made the product, they did a whole photo shoot of people wearing bunny rabbit hats that were like models in bikinis wearing bunny rabbit hats in really weird lighting and all this kind of thing. So it's just absolutely bizarre. The way they delivered their product caused this thing to go viral. Next thing you know, you saw it on every major blog, and it's just hitting the world, but it's just a little product. The product itself wasn't even interesting. It's entirely just how they deliver the message. But, you know, on the other side of things, you'll have many products where the product or the idea is the thing that goes viral. And I know this is getting away from, you know, when we talk about the flu pandemic, but, I mean, I think it's always a combination of either the product or the delivery, and sometimes it's both. But I think the real root of it that I find interesting is that the mediums themselves today, like Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, the blogosphere, have accelerated the ability for anything that can make a ripple to take off.
And you've dealt with bubbles, too. I mean, everyone deals with bubbles, .com bubble, housing bubble. You know, what bubble would you say we're in right now? Because I've had, like, you know, I don't know, you probably heard of him, Gary Vaynerchuk, who's everywhere, Wine Library TV guy.
Right.
You know, he's been on the show, and you know, this era of it was Web 2.0, what, 2007? Then it was new media, whatever, and then, you know, I don't know, Jobs woke up one day and said it's now going to be called, you know, it's now we're in the era of the information thing, whatever the label they call it, it doesn't really matter. He's talking about the fact that this era of personal branding, which was a nauseating word to me, because it means that we're adopting the corporate paradigm down to the individual. So now people have, just like they did before when they had to be an IBMer or they had to be someone that worked for Hewlett Packard, they had to wave the flag of the corporate entity that was providing them, you know, food and shelter, so to speak, until, of course, they downsized, kicked them out and forgot about them, to themselves. So now you have people that I always think of authors and you know, individual artists like this that are forced to brand themselves. And sort of the icon for that for me has always been a guy like Tom Peters, who,
right,
of course, he wrote Thriving on Chaos about 20 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And now we're exploiting chaos. So chaos gets beat up. It's like, pull over, chaos, we're time to beat you up again. So this era that's come from Web 2.0, the social media, and now we're talking about personal branding. What do you make of that as a trend analyzer, someone who studies this? is this something that is beneficial, liberating, or is it does it have a double-edged sword to it where there's a big, long tail of people that are going to try the personally brand, and like Seth Godin says, you know, only a couple of people make it through the dip, and the rest of them, they're washed away.
And I think the interesting thing is that a lot of what is pushing personal branding to the next level would be social media, and let's use Twitter as our example. So you can have a score associated with you, which is how many followers you are, as a measure of how interesting you are. So the interesting point about that could be that you have the ability to actually get a following. But if you just caught on now, it's nearly impossible for you to reach the level of many of the superstars out there. So Ashton Kutcher was the first celebrity really on it, and as a result, he's got 4 million followers. That makes him number one in the world. But is he the number one most interesting celebrity of all celebrities to follow? That would suggest to you yes. But at this point, it doesn't even matter if you're a superstar celebrity. It doesn't matter if you've already got dozens of movies out there. Your ability to catch up to Ashton Kutcher or even get reasonably close to him is very difficult. So he's made it through that dip, as you've spoken about. But after a while, when people realize how difficult it is and people sort of set in their places, then maybe some of the fad, at least with Twitter, of personal branding, you know, becomes less relevant. But you're right in that there's a double-edged sword. Suddenly you can put a number to how many followers you are, which on one side is cool, but for people starting later in the game, it certainly makes it a lot more difficult.
Now, you've seen this come and go before, because 10 years ago, everybody was running around getting into multi-level marketing. That became the way out of the rat race back then. And as much as personal branding and selling things on the Internet is now, do you just see the technology changing, or are people literally changing the way they communicate as a result of having different sets of tools? And as a result of that, does that skew trends into a different trajectory, or are we basically follow the same wave where – you know, you have the early adopters, you have the people that are kind of the slaggers that lag behind, and you have the herd in the middle.
Well, I think people are definitely changing, and if you think especially of the youngest generation coming up, they're not on Twitter, they're more on Bebo and Facebook, but what's interesting about them is if you look at some of the research of what some of the kids today say, I remember reading one thing where when they're asking a girl like how she looks at different mediums, and this is, you know, maybe a 10, 12-year-old girl, and they said, you know, what would you use email for? And she said, oh, email? Oh, that's only for formal communication. I might use that to thank a friend's mom or something for a party.
It's like
and then they said, okay, well, what, you know, when would you call your friend? It's like, well, first I would check what her status is so that I know, you know, if she's having a good day or not. I'd see if she posted any links or updates. And
wow.
I mean, that's sort of one perspective of how kids look at these different mediums. But the other is that when we're training ourselves to become more and more bite-sized to send Facebook updates or 140-character Twitter statuses, the more you're doing that, you're sort of breaking down everything into its simplest components. Even just anyone who's been addicted to text messaging for, you know, the last 5 years or so knows how much that changes the way that you almost think about things. Like, if I see that my girlfriend is calling me on the phone and leaving a message, I'm going to suddenly, you know, feel frustrated that why is she leaving me a message? It better be important, because otherwise it should have just been a text message, because now I have to dial in and call and all this wonderful stuff.
Now, is all that just complicating communication, or is it making more filters so that, you know, because there's so many things coming at you from an advertising standpoint, not just the permission marketing opt-in stuff that we actually sign up to be abused by, but mainstream media hasn't gone away either. And then when you start dealing with the fact that you filter your conversations with your friends based on, you know, it used to be you screen your voicemail or whatever, and you hear someone leaving a message, you don't answer the phone. Now you check their status to see what mood they're in before you even interact with them.
Yeah.
Have we really shifted from having a kind of a human relationship to having a more kind of hybrid digital relationship with everybody else because of the fact that everything's decentralized?
I think what we've done is, decentralized is a good word for it. We've spread out our relationships, where you might have had deep relationships with your best friend and your girlfriend, boyfriend, wife, husband, whatever, and your family. and maybe you'd call them daily for an hour, suddenly you have many more relationships that you can keep in touch with people because you've made it, each of these successive inventions makes it a little bit easier to keep in contact with someone. There might be someone that I would send a text message to, but I didn't really want to call them because I didn't really feel like I was sort of that close to want to talk to them that day. Push that to Facebook, suddenly you see a friend where it's neat because you went to school with them or you were on a trip and you met up with them on the trip and you're kind of interested enough to see their new pictures that come out from their last trip and you'll write something, but otherwise you would never have kept in contact in any way. Then go to Twitter and suddenly you're going to direct message someone else that you saw had a bad time at the same restaurant as you, even though you've never met that person because you have that single one link. And so it seems like each thing we're doing is kind of spreading our cells, and there's a way that it's pretty neat. I mean, it's more interconnected, and you have the potential to sort of really broaden your network and the opportunities that might arise. And, you know, for some that would feel weird, especially people that are much more traditional, because you are going to lose depth. You can't have both.
And what's the cutoff as far as technologically savvy, comfortable, and able to be flexible, and technologically a little bit rigid and unreceptive? Is it used to be don't trust anybody, you know, over 30, whatever the expression was. And, you know, I've had, Jeff Gardner talking about the X generation having less population. They always had to kind of basically be the techies and be the guys that were rooting around. We have the millennials, which is a population that rivals the boomers in terms of numbers. Do you see a connection that basically, as usual, the Xers get bypassed because of the sheer volume of generation preceded generation that's behind it? Or do you see it's an individual thing where at a certain point in life, you know, between, say, 25 and 50, you sort of find the five or six ways that you want to communicate with people that you're competent at, and you don't adopt the new toy. You let that toy go.
Well, the one thing I'll give you that's kind of interesting. Oh, sorry, it's all staticky. The one thing I'll tell you that's kind of neat is I don't remember the exact number, but the proportion of people who are under 25 on Twitter is a very small amount. Let's say it's 15%. So okay. You think about these new technologies as often being just for the youngest generation. But in Twitter's case, that's not actually so. And one of the reasons is that Twitter is for people who have something to say. It's for sharing news and opinion. And whereas Facebook and Bebo are for people who want to see what their friends are doing. So when you talk then about Twitter, you're actually talking about young urban professionals or even people, let's say, that are 35 to 45, because they're trying to figure out how to use it for their company, how to use it for their brands, and this sort of thing. So then from that perspective, you're not necessarily seeing that Gen X being sandwiched in between the other two generations. I think it gets to mindset and the type of role that one does. And in your role or for who you are as a person, do you see being on top of the next trends as being important? And if you do, you're going to be in that space. Now, if we fast forward 10 years when all the youngest generation does have something to say, then they will be on whatever version of Twitter is. And those that are sort of always denying the next modern advances are going to be a little bit left behind.
So there's sort of a backlog in a way, because we're almost kind of in a point now where we're heading into, I don't want to say a technological gridlock. Everyone I've ever talked to, and I've had Neil Patel on the show, all these other techie guys, that get into this concept of the singularity, where we've already done that a little bit with the phone, making that almost everything. Television's the next thing, where we used to have everything was kind of very separate and very distinct. You had your network television, you had your cable television, and now you're starting to see HD and things starting to merge with the computer. At what point will this actually happen? Will we slide all these things into a unified sort of a spectrum of technology, rather than when you go to the Sharper Image store or whatever, you've got so many different things to think about. Okay, what plasma TV do I want? Where it's all basically one kind of like one big box you just walk out the door with.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think for some of these technologies, you'll see certain things merge. So when you see Facebook buy Friendfeed, or when you see, Google buy whoever, you're slowly seeing some of these technologies merge into the person that can provide them at a much better level, and eventually there's going to be a more seamless product that we're all using, and then we'll be looking for some other new innovation. But in terms of when do people get left behind or what forces things to go a little quicker, I mean, you're reminding me when you're talking about that about Facebook. And when I think about Facebook, I think about party invites as an example. So I have a couple people that I know that are not on Facebook, and any time that I have a party, I routinely forget about them. And I've talked about this with other friends who say the same thing, because now when you're getting ready for your party and you're organizing and you can send out 100 invites or whatever you want to do through Facebook, you don't even think about your two or three friends that have that stance that, no, I'm not going to get on it. And, you know, they'll miss one or two events, and after a while, it's like, okay, fine, I just have to do it because otherwise now I'm going to be excluded socially or whatever that might mean. So
it's like a digital peer pressure.
Yeah, yeah. I think that there's a part of that where at a certain point when everyone, you know, so to speak, is kind of doing it, then the people who were a little bit resistant will just fold. The laggards have to kind of do it because otherwise, you know, they literally do get left behind and don't get invited to the party.
So let's tackle some big fish here before we wrap up. Healthcare, big issue. Everybody's into it. There's a lot of, I mean, we've gone through some layers here. 5-6 years ago, HIPAA, the Information Act, came out. Protect the client-doctor relationship. You know, information was going to be private, right? Insurance companies, the weasels that they are, always figure out a way to kind of be involved in that conversation. So you always have to deal with that, hospital records, things like that. Bluetooth comes in as a technology, as an example, right? Wireless, whatever. Now, if you're going to tackle the cost and delivery and the quality of healthcare as a trend hunter, what is going to solve this problem? Because every politician and every, you know, physician I've talked to has a big balloon model in their head of how to solve it, but they're not connected to the whole system. You, who have the seat in the Captain Kirk chair, you can see all everything going on. Mm-hmm. How do you connect the dots here? Because it is something that has become, what, a 6-month, 7-month conversation that we still haven't solved yet?
Well, so first of all, for some context, I come from Canada, so I'm not as in-depth of some of the U.S. politics on healthcare. But having said that, the other side of it is that I've actually done a lot of work as a consultant in the wonderful world of healthcare up in Canada. Yeah. So I think that one of the things that starts complicating it in like global sort of circumstance is that the biggest driver of cost is not the medications that are increasing, because they're actually a very small proportion, and it's not really the salaries of people, it's the standard of care and what people kind of expect, and this is what causes people to get in such a big bind. So for example, when you used to have a baby, you used to get one ultrasound. That was what was normal, if you rewind back to, like, let's say 15 or 20 years.
Yeah.
But now, you know, go back 5 years ago, suddenly you have an ultrasound every trimester. Then
again,
go to now, and it's even more. But that kind of thing, that's really huge, because now you're causing the whole system that everybody uses, so it's the biggest business in a way. Everyone uses it, and it's increasing exponentially, but you just can't pay for it because you can't make everyone pay exponentially more taxes or whatever it's going to be to cover it. So it's one of the most difficult problems I think there is to solve.
And again, it's one of those ones because of the fact that you're dealing with a heck of a lot of, pork. There's a lot of waste in there, unnecessary stuff because of the way the insurance industry squeezed the doctors. The doctors have to say, listen, if you're not going to pay for my visits, I'm going to order more tests, and you've got millions of dollars of unnecessary tests going on. Technology, again, MRIs, all those other things. And one of the things that happened in pregnancy, they made pregnancy basically a 9-month disease, where you're tested almost incessantly to see if there's something wrong with the baby or you, and you have to make choices all the way along the line, whether it's going to be amnio or, oh my God, if you have a kid that has some type of issue genetically, do you want to abort the child? You got so many months for that. There's the diabetes that comes up, all the issues with the mother's health. It is endless. And then being you know, if it's as easy as
it's true.
A physician, you could be a clinician, it's tough.
And I've seen a chart. I don't know if this is something you could Google and find right away, but
okay,
basically with something like life expectancy over time, and it was basically comparing the U.S. to other countries, and then the other axis it had was the amount that's spent. And basically you have the U.S. with costs of per-person health care just skyrocketing, like astronomically higher than any other country, but no real changes in life expectancy. You know, not enough when you look at it. It stands out, and it kind of gets to what you're saying. So if you're spending 9 months having the most amazing of tests and 4D X-rays, and this is the latest thing for pregnancies. I just saw my sister's 4D X-ray about a month ago or whatever, and you can actually see the baby or whatever. But I mean, these are not things that are cheap, and not things that happened before, and so it causes complication. And when we look on Trend Hunter, you know, and if you're asking me to look in that crystal ball, well, I see a lot of really cool healthcare technologies, but you know, I'm sure each of them come with a significant price tag. So that's the constraint that needs to be addressed.
And again, dealing with it from a bell curve perspective here, you've got the 80 and over generation that, I mean, we're going to have more of them as the boomers get older and retire, like you were talking about before. And then
yeah, that's actually that's actually the biggest sort of bubble that's about to happen, which is that in the next 10 years, you're going to have the 10, 20 years, you're going to have the most expensive, fastest growing group put much more weight on the system than ever before.
And they'll be cranky.
They got demands. They paid taxes for decades.
Oh, they're going to be cranky as hell. They're not going to be like this like very quiet, you know, World War II generation that just like rolled off the planet, you know. The boomers are going to go kicking, screaming, yelling, grabbing. They're not going to be happy about dying or getting old or retiring at all. And they're going to want the same treatment they've gotten their entire existence, which is a giant parade of how great they are. And being an Xer and sort of someone that got on the caboose of the boom, and I was born in 64, so depending on what book you read, I'm you know, sort of sliding between the two doors there. But I lived the life of an Xer while being basically on the last train to Clarksville on the boomer train. And as I've gotten older, in my 40s now, I relate much better to kids in their 20s and early 30s and the way that they see the world than maybe people 10 or 15 years older than me, who, because they had to go through the old ladder, and the old ladder meant, you know, hunker down, keep your nose clean, get your promotion, get your corner office, you know, stay in the corporation for 40 years, that was still prevalent 15 years ahead of me. 15 years behind me, you had guys being CEOs, and they were 25 in the dot-com bubble, and they were going, you know, IPO, and it was like, you know, their icons are, you know, it's like
sure.
They look at the Mavericks owner and, you know, and you know, Mark Cuban and
yeah,
A-Rod and guys like that, that just keep basically becoming their own, you know, like Shaq. They become their own circle. LeBron, they become their own business within a business. And then they partner with the big fish. So then you get a whole bunch of kids now that are, you know, just turning 20 that think in 5 years they're going to run a $1 million company. Well, guess what? Chicky ain't getting it. It's going to be there no more. So how do you – the bridge is out. So how do we negotiate people through the unreality that preceded it and the stark reality that's coming over the mountain when you have such a laziness and such an apathy and such a sort of mad skills, man, where you don't have the formal training anymore. People don't want to put up with the four-year commercial that is undergrad and go into debt and then be out in the workforce 4 years behind their competition – who, you know, maybe they've been building websites since they're 16 years old, and now they've partnered with five or six people, and they bought software companies. Neil Patel's a perfect example. How old is the guy? 24 years old. He's been through like four or five, you know, fortunes already. And then you got the traditional approach, which is to, you know, get a good SAT score, go to school, go $60,000 in debt, and then come out and get a job at entry level for $40,000-$50,000. And maybe by the time you're 30, you know, you might have all your hair fall out, but maybe by then we'll give you a little reward. How do we change that model, given the fact that the technological landscape has completely transmogrified?
Well, I think what's interesting is that there's always a culture counterculture, and the counterculture kind of eventually becomes the culture. It rotates, and that's because we always want to be different. We want to be a little rebellious. We don't like what we see in front of us, and we want something new. And so if you look at athletes, you know, if you redial back to the 70s, there were some big athletes, but it was the owners and it was the
right.
companies, or sort of the like sports teams that were the hero. But then, you know, Nike came out and started making, you know, Jordan the icon, and you started having the for the first time the rise of the sort of individualist, and these icons drove our culture. And whether it's Jordan all the way up to Tiger Woods, you saw just these, you know, megastar athletes that meant more than anything in their whole sport, and that kind of drove everything. But then you started having, let's say, over the last decade, a rise in a lot of these, let's say, surf culture has been probably one of the biggest ones popping out, or mountain biking, or some of these extreme sports where you
right.
actually don't even really know the players. Or I remember seeing this Mountain Dew commercial, which, you know, I sort of studied because Mountain Dew always plays up whatever the counterculture is their theme. And the Mountain Dew commercial, it's the one where the guy chases the cheetah and pulls the
right.
the Mountain Dew out of his mouth. I don't know if you've seen this, but basically, you know, but 3-4 guys are on their bikes and they're just doing fun tricks in the desert. They see the cheetah run. The guy gets on his bike, chases after it as much as possible, dives on top of the cheetah, pulls the like, you know, the pop out of its mouth, the can, and then when he drinks it, they show his buddies, and his buddies are like, meh, whatever, and they just start going on to do their other thing. So the point was, even though there was something cool and heroic, it was all about just doing things together, and that's kind of how surfing is and all this. But that's a counterculture to saying that you know the name of the athletes, and you wouldn't do a commercial unless you had a Tiger Woods or a Jordan or something like that. So I think this example is just to say your counterculture will always emerge and challenge and send things back and forth.
And then just, you know, kind of completing that loop in a parallel universe, Sprite was always the one that promoted hip-hop. And, you know, that's always been the drink of the hip-hop generation, so that wherever Sprite went was where the hip-hop community went. I don't know if it's tail wagging the dog. I don't know how any of this stuff really, really works underneath it, but I study a lot of things in mimetics from a brain standpoint of what ideas, you know, get in someone's head and how they act on it and all that stuff. And what I see happening over and over again now, like, as you've been kind of crisscrossing a little bit of how these things work commercially and what's going to go viral and things like that, is that it does take the same basic elements of feedback, exposure, intensity, novelty, all the things that got our attention, you know, 50, 60 years ago with Disney and things like that, are still basically the same ingredients now. The only difference is that it's happening faster, and that it's almost to the point now where it's, I don't want to say it's subliminal, but it's not something that's obvious, but things become sort of integrated into the culture, almost like they kind of meld in. They don't get sold to you as much as they get kind of sold, they're kind of pushed through, and then they're just there. So, you know, I just looking at that life expectancy thing you had me Googling before, you know, I just came up with it here, and it's like, you know, China has the number one, you know, life expectancy from birth, 84 years. Women go to 87.4 years. And U.S., I mean, I'm still scrolling way down here. We're down at number 42. And men, 74, women, 82, overall from birth, 78. So, you know, in terms of the way we educate ourselves.
And probably number one for spend.
Yeah. And in terms of cost, I mean, that's the thing, is that when you just put the cost we spend on fighting cancer and all the other big diseases, and then you see the results and the quality, like you're saying, we're paying for premium quality services. And Canada and Europe has always been looked at as the, oh, we'll just adopt their model, eh? Well, they've got like a tenth of our population. So, you know, it's a completely different way you'd manage 10 million people as opposed to, you know, or 30 million people as opposed to 300 million people. So, again, I'm thinking about this in the same point, the big fish things, like we just talked about with education a little bit with the way we deal with health. I'm going to give you one that maybe you haven't really put through the old hopper yet, because I got involved in chiropractic in the early 90s when it was still basically, you know, I don't want to say it was insignificant, but it, compared to what it is now, it's pretty recognized, and for all the wrong reasons. But halfway through my career, which is about 9, 10 years ago, I got involved in some research like you guys do, but I looked at it culturally and developmentally, where you guys are looking at it much more in terms of commercial. And mimetics and somatics, two completely intellectualized, backwater, academic, frou-frou type of disciplines, became so enthralling to me because I saw through the mirror a little bit, the looking glass, is that because we were in the idea age, because we were marketing ourselves and all this other stuff, that the brain, because it loves candy, was going to go into this era, was went to the decade of the brain, we didn't learn a thing. We just kept studying the brain in a box, and we forgot the body, and we forgot how people relate collectively and indirectly. And I studied the way intelligence was being communicated. And, of course, that efficiency model, all the things that related to that, goes back into my study of nonlinear dynamics, which gets into complexity and chaos theory, which is where we came in an hour ago. So going full circle, I'm sitting in a meeting in Philadelphia, 99, I guess it was, and some grad student from UCLA is coming in to talk to the board of all these guys that run this Society for Chaos Theory. And she's doing a study on memetics of chaos and what words and terms are promoting this model and what words and terms are out. Well, it turned out that chaos, complexity itself, those two terms were bad memes for nonlinear dynamics. Neural networks was the big fish seller 10 years ago, right? So semantics, which is, this is, again, you probably never put that word through the hopper. And I've gone through Google Trends, and I've gone through all the I'm desperately trying to find a way to say semantics without saying semantics. What says it? And, you know, when you look at the semantics community, and again, you probably never study this little fish, but it has a heartbeat that goes through the developmental stuff, the neurobehavioral stuff, the emotional stuff, the people that deal with post-traumatic stress disorder, anyone dealing with addiction, anything that sticks in a body that you can't get out becomes a somatic niche. So my approach to it always has been rather than focus on the pathology, which gets back into that allopathic monster we were talking about a while ago, that promotes fear. Fear seems to sell much, much better than fact. And so when you give people information, especially now, they're so glutted with stuff that they have to, throw away. It's like digital parsley. They can't use it, right? They won't process it. They can't digest it. It's cellulose. When you actually give them facts, information that is true and valid and backed up and all that stuff, it's almost vanilla. You have to sensationalize what's ordinary in order to get someone's attention, which basically perpetuates that corporate model of distortion. How do we get people to pay attention to the truth when the truth has to be sort of silly puttied into their heads?
Well, it's interesting. I think what we encode as humans tends to be these messages. If you think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, when something hits the bottom level, like security is that most fundamental need that you have, that's when you really start paying attention. And actually, you're also reminding me of the sort of anecdote that goes way back to maybe, let's say, 15 years or so, when someone from the National Federal Food Commission basically saw that the type of oil that was being used in popcorn was very dangerous. It was palm oil, which meant it had, let's say 20 grams of the very worst kind of fat you can imagine, but in the serving of popcorn. And so what they were trying to do is figure out, well, how do you just tell people that number and nobody realizes it, no one pays attention to it. And so it made a stick when they talked about it. They said the guy came out and he just put on a platter a steak and some fries and a potato. Another side he had the popcorn, and he said, hey, you know what? This popcorn is more dangerous than having the rest of this meal. And basically, people wouldn't encode the message normally, but as soon as it started seeming like something scary to them or it was dangerous and, that popcorn was worse than something that they thought was good but they liked, then they never wanted the popcorn, and it caused the whole revolt against the palm oil popcorn, and people going to the movie theaters and not ordering anything, so the movie theaters, caused this big pandemic scare. And so I guess, in that case, this helped get that palm oil off the market or whatever. But I think you're very right in that sort of observation that unless you start striking those chords, the message just isn't going to travel as much. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good thing. Sometimes, these messages that travel are bad, and this could lead us down to a fate where all advertising and personal branding takes things to extremes that aren't good. That's where you even start seeing shock advertising. So right now I know on Trend Hunter that, we've got a number of examples we've seen of where there's, fake, to promote Dexter in Europe, they put dead arms in butcher shops. So you're going to buy your meat, and then you see a dead arm with a little sign stabbed in it that says Dexter. That kind
right.
of thing gets so much traffic that then everybody starts copying that. And so then we had a dozen different examples of murdertizing. And, you know, this isn't necessarily a good thing for society, but people have realized that when you do something like that for a very low cost, you get a ton of ad impressions. The blogosphere makes it faster. And in a credit-crunched world, that starts becoming a lot more appealing to your brand. So there's not necessarily a good answer to it, but I think that your observation is correct in that people will keep using fear even more than they have in the past, and this kind of thing ends up driving what is viral.
Yeah, that's, again, this is my issue because, you know, you go back to the old egg in the frying pan for this is your brain on drugs, you know. I don't think that scared any heroin addict from shooting heroin, but it probably took the kid that was, you know, watching that commercial and said, you know what, if it's that dangerous, it must be interesting. So in the era of X and all the other drugs that came out, these social drugs at raves, it became not rebellion, it became inclusion. It became, this is my other family here. And, you know, everything that happened with gangs, it's the same thing. Brains are suckers for inclusion because they like to bomb at other brains. So when it comes to somatics, you know, I my phrase that pays, I guess, again, I'm a bad mimetic guy, but is living in the rhythm. Most people are out of rhythm with their sleep-wake cycle. They're out of rhythm with the way their body repairs and grows. They're definitely out of rhythm with their rest-activity cycle. That's why they're always joining different gyms and trying different exercise things. We can do an hour on stomach machines, you know, all that crap that's come out. And what is the antiviral, I guess, way of spreading things so that you get a quality crowd, not a quantity crowd?
Well, at the end of the day, it's not just about making a message that connects with everyone. It's about trying to have, let's say, a product or message that's irresistible to a specific group of people. So if you create something that remarkably solves your people's need, the other benefit of something like Twitter is that not only do messages spread, but they spread within the communities of people with similar interests. So if you do come up with that, you know, solution for healthcare, or that product, or something that connects with the right group of people, although that might not get you the 10 million views that some big flash mob publicity stunt might, or that something that's like Shockertizing might, you can actually spread your message within the groups where it's important easier than ever before. And so we talked a lot about saying double-edged swords today. I guess the double-edged sword of what is viral is that the messages that get the biggest numbers are always going to be the things that are shocking, daring, and surprising, and that's just going to keep on going. But there is this opportunity that when you make something that connects for your specific group, your message will travel faster than before.
All right, I'll give you a shot before I let you go here. If I say to you mind, body, magic, which is, you know, one of my little taglines, or if I say to you the phrase brain flocker, which of those two do you think has more viral potential?
So what's the last one? What's the second one?
Brain flocker.
Brain flocker. Well, brain flocker sounds like you're saying something else to me.
Yes,
so.
It does.
So that's the one that gets my attention.
Okay. Well, because that's a game about making your brain more street smart,
right,
by being able to recognize what images, because everything's image-driven. Brain Flocker is an image recognition program that basically is a game that you play basically on your desktop or on your phone to recognize cultural images and put them into the code that your brain puts them in. And there's four different basic templates that your brain uses, and Brain Flocker allows you to say, well, did you know that, you know, like Oprah's brain is wired the same way as Madonna's and Sam Cowell's brain, but Will Smith is just like Jessica Simpson, you know? And it's like knowing that, and then which celebrity brain are you wired like is another slug to beer kind of thing that the Brain Flocker program does.
Sure.
And all of it is somatics, but I didn't say somatics. I said Brain Flocker, you know, but when I say mind, body, magic, it goes whoop up the chimney and people go, what the hell is that? Because that one you can't put a fork in because it's transformational, because if you understand somatics, it's a first-person science. It's a subjective science. Every other science is objective, third-person, and dead. So this is a living thing. So that's why when you're dealing with it, you can't say organic or you start thinking everyone's got their granola out. So there's a lot of, like, when you have all these niches, you have to kind of walk over the little bridges to please everybody's little, you know, sensitive minds. You're right. It almost is like you have to hit them in the head with a 2x4 and say, brain flocker, And they go, well, I got to find out what that is. And because it sounds fun to say the word. It sounds like you're cursing. You know, it's like if people go, hey.
Absolutely.
So okay. So I just got my consulting
there you go.
In there. So, okay, we talked about a lot of things. I know you got the book coming out. You're going on the massive digital tour of the universe. It's exploitingchaos.com. It's trendhunter.com for the magazine. And just to give you the shot I give every guest on Summertime, what is the one thing, because everybody skips to the end when they archive, and hear this little question, what is the one thing that we didn't cover or we maybe didn't cover well that is a misconception about the book, your work, whatever, that you'd like to clear up for the audience right now?
Well, I think we covered everything, right? I guess the only other news that we've got is we just launched today our 2010 Premium Trend Report. So for companies that are kind of looking for the next big thing, we use Trend Hunter as an experiment, and we gather all the data as a sort of a crowdsourced, crowd-filtered way of identifying important patterns. And so those just came out at trendhunter.com.
All right. Well, give us one little tip in that report about the holidays. What are we going to see coming out next month and a half? For the holidays that maybe people haven't heard of yet?
So I think you're going to start seeing people trying to give gifts that don't appear to have monetary value and a higher sense of sentiment. So we're seeing a lot of sort of uber personalization and tangible products that are personalized with your image on them, and that you know, you've already seen before where you could customize a coffee mug or a photo album,
right,
or different things like that online, bobbleheads, you name it, are different things that you can get. Suddenly those gifts have a much higher value because you maybe don't spend as much, but you're putting in that sentiment in a time where people care about it more than before.
Wow, so there you go. So viva the potentialists, right?
There you go.
They're the new merchants of the darkness. All right, man, thanks a lot. You covered a lot again. Let's pronounce your name right. Jeremy Gucci, right?
Jeremy Gucci.
Gucci. I got to get the French-Canadian thing in there. Is that what you want, French-Canadian?
that's German, like actually. Yeah.
German? Gucci. It sounds like a brand of like pants or something. I'm wearing my Gucci.
There you go.
Well, all right, man. Well, thanks a lot. Have a happy holiday. Great, great having you on the show. And believe me, we probably will talk again offline about many things that I'm doing on the ground that you might be able to do for us in the sky. So, pleasure meeting you. Great book.
Have a
great
day.
Best luck with it.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Take care now. All right, Jeremy Gucci, joining us tonight. That was wild. I learned a lot. Brain flocker. All right, there's your winner. If you were, if you were interested. And Elvis has a comment, of course, after
the
interview.
What the fuck was he talking about?
That's right. So, I'm going to point to next week and point out into the wilderness. I don't know who's coming on the show, but the guest will be interesting because we're either going to have a guy talking about living on other planets or a guy talking about the future from a very distinct mathematical algorithm that is not astrological. It's not woo, quite woo, but very moo. And if you saw the movie The Men Who Stare at Goats, he's one of them, a literal Jedi. So we're going to figure out which one of those guys will come on next week. Then we got a big Thanksgiving show coming up week before that, and I'm not sure what I'm doing with that, but that will be detailed next time. See if Raging Fred is in.
Don't overcook it. You overcook it, Snowflake.
What are you doing?
You're overcooking. Bring it over.
What's that?
It's like a piece of charcoal. Bring it over here.
There you go. So anyway, for everybody here on the show, everybody listening, everybody not listening, everybody archiving, I had a great time tonight, and we're going to be doing a lot of changes on somaspace.org. So be sure to check that out, and we'll be back next week at 9 p.m. in the East to travel light through the darkness. Brain flocka. All right, so let's see. And we'll boot us up, take us out. There you go. Enjoy the CMA, Sapes. Travel light. See you next week.
Texas.
Sapiens.